Support for Politics and Public Policy Reporting on SDPB is made possible by SDN Communications, your business broadband provider. Learn more at sdncommunications.com.
Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. It's Wednesday, it's noon, and it's time for the Dakota Political Junkies. This is our weekly update and analysis of the state's top political headlines. Joining us this week on the phone from Madison, we have John Hunter, publisher of Madison Daily Leader. John, welcome back.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for asking.
Also with us, Seth Tupper, Rapid City Journal Enterprise reporter. He joins us from inside the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio at SDPB's Black Hills studio. Seth, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's start with John Hunter, and I'm wondering about how newsprint tariffs are impacting you. That's a total surprise. We didn't know we were going to talk about that, but we talked about it earlier this week with Dave Bordwick of the South Dakota Newspaper Association. I'm wondering how it's affecting you, your operation in Madison.
Well, let's ad lib then, Laurie. United States International Trade Commission just voted unanimously a little less than 2 hours ago to repeal the tariffs that have been placed on newsprint from Canada. It's a long and complicated subject, more than our political viewers or listeners would like to hear. But in a nutshell, that there was a mill in or a paper-making company in Washington State who had accused the Canadian government of dumping the raw material for newsprint underpriced, right, that would favor them. And so the Commerce Department said, yep, that sounds right, so we'll slap tariffs on newsprint coming to the United States of as high as 32%. And it was a huge price increase for all of us, very harmful to all printed newspapers and other magazines and such that use similar paper. Very harmful. It started late last year and continued. Briefly, the Commerce Department then said a few weeks ago, yes, these tariffs are going to be permanent, but we'll cut the rate. We'll cut them down to about 16%. That's partly good news, but then this appeal to the International Trade Commission then said, nope, they're done. And so sometime soon, we'd hope to see those tariffs taken off and lower newsprint prices.
All right, it's not ad-libbing; it's breaking news, John Hunter. Because I was, as soon as I said your name, I thought, wait a minute, that vote was today, wasn't it? And see, you had the details. So thank you for that.
Yeah, so it's great news, frankly. Yeah. I mean, you can expand it not only to the companies that operate newspapers, but really for the First Amendment and free press. Yeah. You know, they're. High prices for all those kind of things would have discouraged, maybe even closed some papers, and so it's good for America.
Let's talk about some of the state political headlines, and let's start with the gubernatorial race, because Billy Sutton and Kristi Noem going head-to-head, and Seth Tupper, the idea about how often they should get together and debate, or how often they should say yes to debates and political forums, is something the Sutton campaign is pointing out as part of their strategy. Give us an update of the disparity in what Billy Sutton has said he's willing to do and what Congresswoman Noem has said she's willing to do.
Yeah, and it's important to note this is something that comes up in every, you know, election cycle, kind of a standard part of the playbook. But it is worth discussing because obviously debates are something that gives the public a rare opportunity to see the two candidates, you know, thinking on their feet and reacting to one another and taking questions. And so Billy Sutton's campaign has taken issue with this. They say that they have agreed to at least 10 debates or forums and are in the process of scheduling more. And Kristi Noem's campaign has agreed so far to, as far as I know, to just two debates, televised debates in October. And so there's obviously a discrepancy there. You know, usually the person who considers themselves the front runner isn't interested in doing a whole lot of debates because you can potentially say something wrong or get yourself into trouble or say something you didn't mean to in a debate. So therefore, it's usually natural that somebody who considers themselves a front runner will want to do fewer debates than the challenger. So that's nothing new. But there were some notable exceptions here, you know, as far as like the Dakota Fest debate in Mitchell, which has traditionally been in past years, you know, a place where we've had some very good debates. That didn't happen this year. You know, the State Fair is another place we've usually had some very good debates. And so there are some usual suspects for debates that are kind of being left out here. Mm.
John Hunter, part of the playbook, but then also the Sutton campaign is making a connection between the disparity in debates to Noem's voting record in Congress. What's the game plan there for the Sutton campaign?
Well, that's another strategy I think used by challengers against incumbents. Kristi Noem is not an incumbent really running for governor. Of course, she's been in the U.S. House of Representatives, but they're trying to make the connection. Look, if you're not showing for votes there, what makes you think you're going to show up to peer? It's a pretty weak connection, really. There are different positions and so on, but that's a bit of an issue. And for the challenger, as Seth was pointing out, they want to get as many of these things as possible, and I can't blame them. Frankly, I think both candidates are articulate enough and know the topics well enough that they could debate as often as they wanted, and I don't think it would harm anyone. And frankly, it might clarify things. Both are thoughtful, and they put their platforms together and so forth. So I don't see it. Ironically, of course, if Kristi accepted all 10 or 12 or whatever there are, then she would probably miss more votes in the U.S. House because you're back in South Dakota doing debates all the time. So right, I don't know what the trade-off is.
All right. Seth, do voters key in on this sort of thing, or is it just one of those things where we just say, hey, we talk about it every year or every election cycle, but honestly, do voters hold? Nobody's mind is going to be changed by the number of debates.
I don't think so, but certainly, you know, fewer debates gives voters less chance to be exposed to these candidates. And if you don't have very many debates, you're left with just basically what voters see in the TV advertisements, what they read or view in the news when they have a chance in their busy lives. And so, you know, you have a debate that you have a chance to go to or see on TV. That's a pretty extended period to hear directly from the candidates. So it's I don't know that voters are generally keying in on the issue of how many debates there are, but I think, you know, sort of unconsciously, they're obviously missing out on some information maybe they would otherwise have if there's not as many debates as there otherwise would be.
The debate on South Dakota Public Broadcasting is October 25th, by the way. Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about some of the work, Seth, that you've been doing about this the orphan natural gas wells near Buffalo, South Dakota, and give us a little background on the project itself, and then we'll talk about some of the problems that the abandonment of the project is causing for landowners and possibly for the state budget. So first, a little background about who these companies are and what they were looking for in the beginning.
Sure. So the project began way back in 2006, and it was begun by a company called Spyglass Cedar Creek, which was out of Texas. And the company initially had $22 million in financing from a lender called CIT Group to develop a natural gas project up in the northwestern corner of the state near Buffalo. And the project began seemingly well enough, but by 2008, the lender, CIT, had gone under in the financial crisis and had declared bankruptcy. Then the lender came out of bankruptcy and wanted its money from Spyglass Cedar Creek, the creator of the project, who by that time was behind on the debt because natural gas price had plummeted. And long story short, Spyglass Cedar Creek ended up partnering with another company, New Frontier Energy, out of Colorado, to try to keep the project going. And one of the executives of New Frontier ended up being indicted in Pennsylvania for federal tax evasion. And so it's been one thing after another, but this project has basically kind of flown under the radar as far as I could see until recently, when after all kinds of problems resulting from, you know, several years of basically neglect of these 40 natural gas wells that were drilled up there, the State Department of Environment and Natural Resources started an action to potentially revoke the permits for this project. And meanwhile, there are landowners up there near Buffalo who have what are basically now abandoned natural gas wells on their property. Some of them are leaking. Some of them are in poor condition, and nobody knows what's going to happen with these wells, if they're ever going to get used or plugged, or if they're just going to sit there and continue to deteriorate.
So what efforts is the state of South Dakota making to sort of hold the business, folks accountable they've received some royalties, but yet that might not be enough to sort of handle right. what needs to happen next. How is the state sort of handling this crisis? Well, I don't think is an overstatement to use the word crisis if it's on your land.
This is where the politics comes into it. When the company started the project, it was only required to post a total of $30,000 in bond money. And apparently, 3 years ago, unbeknownst to the DENR, the company cashed out $20,000 of that bond, which had been held as a CD, a certificate of deposit, at a Texas bank. Now there's only about $10,000 left, and I've been told by an industry expert it might cost $30,000 a piece to plug these 40 wells. So the landowners up there are asking, you know, why don't we require more bonding from these companies when they start these kinds of projects? This, after all, was, as I said, a $22 million project initially. That's how it was envisioned, that now we only have $10,000 of bond money to clean up after. So I did do a story, besides just retelling sort of the saga of this project, asking some legislators and other folks, you know, if we should be raising bond amounts, and that's something that I think maybe will be a legislation that will come up in the next session. We'll see, but there are certainly some landowners near Buffalo who would support a fresh look at that.
And Senator Ryan Maher, state senator, who represents the area, says, you know, the lobbyists hold pretty big sway. He introduced legislation in the past. So another political point there from Senator Maher.
Yeah, he had legislation in 2013 that sought to significantly increase the amount of bonding that was required of oil and gas projects. But the bill kind of got watered down as it went through the process, and it did make a change. But, it's kind of complex, but if you run the numbers, you could argue that this project near Buffalo, if it began today, would still only be required to post $30,000 in bond despite those legislative changes.
Right.
And so it's, and Senator Maher, in my interview with him, basically said that the oil and gas interests have more influence with their lobbyists than he can have as one legislator from, you know, a very rural and remote corner of South Dakota.
Mm. John Hunter, we need the price of newsprint to be reasonable so Seth Tupper has enough space to write about the oil and gas projects.
We just about ran out of space on that one, by the way.
You can find it at rapidcityjournal.com. And, you know, I read the whole thing, Seth, and not only do I now understand the difference between surface rights and mineral rights, but, it was an incredibly interesting read all the way through. It was great work on that one.
It was great journalism, and Seth really put that together. Laurie, if I may sneak in with something here. You know, the world has changed a lot since the days of kind of wildcatting for oil in Oklahoma and so forth, at a time when we thought, people in the industry thought that the sky was kind of an unlimited place to had the unlimited capacity to take waste, and the ground wasn't that big a deal. And we've discovered that they're both a big deal. And so now, again, to have tiny bonds or tiny insurance claims, or if even someone says, hey, we're boasting of big financing, that doesn't mean anything.
Right.
And the ease of creating LLCs can easily protect anyone from putting up money. So clearly the law has to change about, cleaning up spills in oil pipelines, any of these kinds of things. Hey, the world has changed so much since people just were so desperate for oil and gas discovery versus the protection of the environment, that it seems hard to think that we haven't adapted in the decades since those things were put together to require much more financial responsibility for the companies.
And Seth, in this case, although there is some royalty money that was paid, it by no means matches what the cost will be for this particular project. Any chance that another company can come along and take over the project, fix things, and move it forward? What are the roadblocks to that happening?
There apparently is that chance. I interviewed a oil and gas industry person who represented a company that was interested in acquiring the project, but he said that in his contacts with this company, Spyglass Cedar Creek, and the man who operates it, that they'd been basically just turned away and didn't know why. And so we'll see. If the company loses its permits, that'll possibly open up a new set of possibilities. I'm not sure, but that's the frustrating part, and is what the landowners up there told me, is they have no idea what will happen, and nor does seemingly anyone else at this point.
Hmm. All right, let's talk about the upcoming legislative special session on online sales tax. John Hunter, this is pretty cut and dry, really, as far as what's going to be happening up here on September 12th.
Seems like it to me the legislature has to make some rule changes in order for this to be done completely. You may remember that the Supreme Court ruled in South Dakota's favor that a state can require sales tax collection of sales from online or catalog or 800 number companies that do business in the state, even if they don't have a physical presence, which was the previous limitation. So, I think it'll be a relatively quick session. I don't see opposition to any of the kind of thing brewing. So, I think but it does have to be passed by the legislature. It can't be initiated by executive order. So, I would guess it would be in and out pretty quickly.
All right, and SDPB's Lee Strubinger will be there that day with coverage from the State House and Pier. And at last, we have an update. Seth, let's start with you on the Paul Erickson and Maria Butina story. There are sort of, you've been following the developments and what her legal team is putting forth now, and a lot of it has to do with trying to get her to prove that she's not a flight risk and sort of to prove that the relationship between Butina and Paul Erickson was a legitimate one. Give us an update of where we stand now.
Yeah, so Butina is charged with basically conspiring to act as an unregistered foreign agent for Russia, and there's a person identified in the prosecution documents as U.S. Person 1, who apparently everyone in the universe now believes is Paul Erickson. It's just kind of become a settled fact at this point. But on Friday, Butina's attorney filed a memorandum in support of a request to get her released from jail with electronic monitoring as she awaits trial. And part of the strategy there was that to show that she's not a flight risk, that she's in a legitimate romantic relationship with Paul Erickson, who grew up in Vermilion and has an apartment in Sioux Falls, and that they're a legitimate couple. And it's gotten a bizarre story. It got even more bizarre when Butina's attorney granted an extended interview to ABC News and let out several videos and photos. One video of Erickson and Butina singing a duet of Beauty and the Beast together, which was apparently intended to show how in love they are. I did a story today just following up on the fact that despite all of that, kind of buried in the court filing, was an exhibit that shows that in the weeks leading up to her arrest on these charges of allegedly being a Russian agent, Maria Butina was also talking to the FBI in South Dakota about what is apparently a fraud investigation into Erickson back here. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, you have them making the case that they have this great loving relationship. On the other hand, she was keeping her apparent boyfriend in the dark about information she was offering to investigators, potentially about him.
So. And after serious contemplation, we have decided not to play audio from the Beauty and Beast duet between Butina and Erickson, because we were quite sure we would lose the fine listeners of South Dakota Public Broadcasting as soon as we hit play on.
Well, you can, if you wish, you can you go can to my go story up. At rapidcityjournal.com.
I'm going
to
make you work for it. Go find it at rapidcityjournal.com, because it's just not worth our airwaves. But John Hunter, any final thoughts on what's happening in the state this week or on the Butina case?
Yeah, Lori, if you ever get into trouble, we can find some of that old karaoke tape that we must have somewhere. Someone has it.
I can honestly tell you, I've never once sang karaoke in my life.
Okay,
so.
we'll find something else then.
We'll find there's lots of other stuff, but not that. John Hunter with the Madison Daily Leader publisher, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks, Lori.
And Seth Tupper, RapidCityJournal.com, Rapid City Journal Enterprise Reporter. Seth, thanks for being here.
You're welcome.